Good morning, everybody. Can everybody see the whole screen? Okay. As long as you can see the whole screen, that will be fine. It's always a very special honor for me to be invited by groups of people from the traditional religions, because I just always feel it very, very deeply that they would come to me as a scientist to talk about their faith. And I've had absolutely wonderful times with Tom Berry, whom some of you know, his writings. I was once in a conference called Three Women in Dialogue with Tom Berry up at a Catholic retreat center in Canada, and it was just a delicious time. I told Gail a little bit about it on the way over. And Dominican nuns in Long Island, we had a wonderful conference there with them. And they were literally asking about how to move their faith forward into a modern world. So that's very deep for me. Also, Episcopalian bishops and priests have come and asked me the same kinds of questions. So this is more important and more serious for me than many of the other venues that I speak in, even though they may have prestige values. So let's get going. This Greek temple is what's left of the temple of Aphea on the island of Aegina, where I lived for some time. And a meeting of science and spirit, biology of the divine. Now, I was very happy with the book, Alice, by Giamud Omurku, and he says lay people ask different questions than do clerics. The struggle and challenge to live with greater meaning and integrity in a world battered and bruised by the forces of patriarchy, often under the aegis of formal religion. That's quite a mouthful, but I think it's wonderful to see so many men in the audience today. I wasn't expecting that, and I think that's just great. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I wanted to know early on, who are we humans? Where do we come from? Where are we headed? So that's why I studied biology, thinking that would be the way to answer these questions, with humanity as a species being considered. And I became a pastist in order to become a futurist. An evolution biologist is a pastist. And I reckon that you needed a trajectory from the past in order to see where we were heading. So that made sense to me, and you'll enjoy that little evolution trajectory there, which ends up with the man back in the position of the hunched over ape on the in front of his computer this time. Science didn't answer those big questions for me, and so when I went to Greece, I went to write novels, actually, to explain the human condition to myself, because I didn't think science was going to answer my questions. But I stayed 13 years, and during that time, I wrote hundreds of essays and reflected, and of the three novels I wrote, I burned two of them. One is still gathering dust in my filing cabinet. Eventually I decided I still wanted to be a scientist. I still wanted to understand this universe and this planet. And so I went back to science working on my own, and was delighted to discover that the ancient Greeks, who called science philosophia, had called it the lover of wisdom, meaning, okay, had called it the search for guidance in human affairs through understanding nature. Now that was exactly what I had in mind when I went into science. I wanted to know how we can guide humanity well into the future by knowing something about the natural world, which we were a part of. So Greece did take me back to science, even though I had to start over, look at the very foundations of Western science, and do it in my own way. This is a fantastic view of the full moon over Cape Sunion, the Aphea temple in the first slide, and Cape Sunion, the Poseidon temple there, and the Parthenon made a triangle in ancient days, and the atmosphere was so clear back then that they could actually see each other in that triangle. Can't do that anymore. My best thinking was done on a fishing boat, especially at night, when I was aware of myself as being halfway between the macrocosm and the microcosm, because the sky and the sea were all one black inky field, and the stars looked exactly like the plankton I could stir up in the water, the bioluminescent plankton. They were the tiny world, the stars were the great vast world, and I was so aware of being halfway between them that it was almost like mystical experiences. And I also walked a lot in Greek forests, and at night I would stand on my roof, and I really didn't have an active practicing religion at all. I wasn't sure that I was even interested in religion, having become a scientist, but I used to swing my arms up to the night sky and say, use me. Didn't know who I was talking to, or if anyone was listening, or anything was listening, but I just felt like saying that to the sky, use me, and in retrospect, I think my prayer was answered. So now I travel the world to show people a new way of seeing evolution as a sacred, conscious self-creation in nature. Just a few of the venues I've been in lately so that you'll know what I do around the world there. The World Spirit Forum this past January in this spectacular place in Arosa, Switzerland, just a mountain over from the World Economic Forum. We have the World Spirit Forum, and they invited the World Wisdom Council, of which I'm a member, to be there. It was fantastic. And then we were in Tokyo for Forum 2005, Creating a New Civilization. And there I was on a small panel with Gorbachev, you can see, and to prove that that's me and him. And my friend Patrick Busey, who was a Mitsubishi CEO here in the United States and is a wonderful man, talking about progressive ways of changing our economics, our businesses, so that they become accountable to all their stakeholders, not just their shareholders. Very important stuff. The Co-Round Table is a group of businessmen from Japan, Europe, and the United States, and their work is about bringing ethics into business. And probably the most interesting event I attended this year was this roundtable of free voices in Berlin just last month in September, where 112 of us sat at this huge round table, it's the size of a football field, each at our own personal TV station, answering the 100 most burning questions of people all over the world. 20,000 questions had been submitted from all over, and 112 of us were from all over the world. That's Daniel Defoe, who plays Spider-Man, and my friend Hafsat Abiola from Nigeria, a fantastic young woman. And they read the questions aloud, and then we had 3 minutes for each one. And if you're interested, the website droppingknowledge.org has all 11,200 of our answers. Then I went back to Brazil, and these are young people who live in the very poorest favelas in Brazil, and were learning to drum. A famous Brazilian drummer was teaching them to work as a group, and just doing terrific work with them. And the young man in the lower right is my adopted son, Puma, from Peru. Maybe Gail can connect you with him. He's an amazing young man, because I also lived in the Peruvian Andes for a year. And this is Machu Picchu, that's just for you, Gail. And that I am sitting where that I put the red star. That is called Wanu Picchu. It's the baby Picchu, as opposed to Machu, the big one. And you climb straight up that mountain to the top. I hope you'll do that, because it's a wonderful adventure. I've been up there several times, so you can do it easy. Now, Puma's people are called the Runa Kuna. That's what they call themselves. And Don Maxibo Puma Singona is his grandfather in the black suit here on the right. These are his biological parents. And that's his new wife, Edith. He was trained for 21 years from the ages of 3 to 24 as a medicine priest, and now he has a new wife and a son, and look at this baby when it's 3 days old. Now this is a baby whose daddy has been in communion with it from the day it was conceived. And his grandfather delivered all the babies in their town for half a century, never lost one. They are in such deep communion with the baby that they know exactly what the baby needs when it's ready and everything else. And boy, isn't that a present baby. Now, what's interesting about that culture to me is that reality is defined in that culture as each person's experience and all people's experience together. There's no effort made to have a single objective reality that everyone is supposed to believe in. And when you take this definition of reality, you find plenty of commonalities among you that are easy to agree on, and yet you can accept someone else's reality without having to make it your own. Now, Dr. Phil, the pop psychologist Oprah made famous, has said 90% of the arguments in marriage would disappear if we got this, that everyone has a different reality, and that most arguments are bullying sessions to see what, who can convince who that their reality is the true one. And if people could just say, well, obviously we have two realities about that, so let's drop it and go on, life would be a lot happier. Now, what's interesting is, if you go to Webster's Online Dictionary, you find the first three definitions of reality use the word real, so you have to toss them out. Doesn't do any good to hear that reality is what's real. Right? The fourth one, to my shock, was non-derivative experience. First-hand. Not somebody else's experience, but your own. Isn't that fascinating? This is the definition that Polish culture used. I had no idea it was even existed in my own culture. Because it's not what I was taught in school about reality. Reality is usually decided these days by science. We'll talk about that. Anyway, each of us builds our own world, our own reality, from stories, from personal perceptions, from emotions, from values, from all of these tools that we evolve in our own lives so that we can have experience. And of course, the six blind men around the elephant was one of those parables that showed how different people's realities were, right? Now, I want to go back to beginnings, early humanity. And when we first represented our experience in pictures and language to each other and became storytellers. From the beginning, humans, as they developed language, became storytellers, telling each other, sharing their experience through stories. That is how we weave culture. And to this day, we have religious stories and scientific stories and all kinds of stories that we tell each other in order to talk about the world that we live in together, don't we? And then our realities reflect our stories and beliefs, which is why different cultures have such different realities. And the most fascinating thing about our world today is that people can have very different realities within the same family. How many of you have that experience? Look at that. You know, it wasn't always like that. Thomas culture is probably much more agreed on as to reality than ours is today. And that's why we need to adapt Thomas culture's definition of reality, because it's the only way we can learn the tolerance required to deal with our own relatives when they have completely different views. I had one relative from Germany yesterday email me with congratulations for our elections. I don't dare to say anything to my elder brother because I'm sure he's very unhappy. as a retired Marine colonel. Anyway, part of the storytelling that we did with each other, of course, was telling each other stories of creation. How did our world come to be? How did we get to be part of it? And from very earliest times, we worshipped idealized beings as our deities. This is a fascinating place. Has anyone ever been to Malta? This is called the Hypogeum. And the very first deity in many early cultures that we know about was a mother creatrix. And that's her asleep in the lower right-hand corner. This is an amazing underground chamber, a kind of womb in Malta. Now, I remember when these pictures first came out in National Geographic in the 1970s, and they had taken these aerial shots of these temples and said, very weird shape, nobody knows what it was. Right? Even though the statues of the great thunder-side mother goddess was there in those temples, they couldn't figure out what these temple shapes were supposed to be. In Greece, of course, Gaia, as we call her today, was called Gaia. In Rome, she became Gia, and all of our words about Earth, geology, geometry, geography, all come from that ancient Earth goddess who was the creatrix of Earth. Hesiod said she was the mother of all. And as such, the first Pythia, the oracle at Delphi, who guarded the sacred Castalian spring, sat on a tripod in a cave inhaling fumes, falling into a trance to deliver oracles from the earth. This is Coyolxauhqui, the moon goddess in Mexico, whose son and the war god brother, Huitzilopochtli, dismembered her and threw her head into the sky, where it became the moon. And this stone is as big as the Aztec calendar stone and was found by electricity company workers installing cables on February 21st, 1978. And when I saw that date, I had a feeling it was connected to the mother who was Sri Aurobindo's partner in India. And sure enough, after 4 months, I established that this stone came up, the dismembered goddess who needs to be remembered, comes up on her 100th birthday. Isn't that interesting? Because she always said, I will come back in various forms and things like that. Anyway, every human culture has been built from stories, their own creation stories, whatever they were, scientific, religion, what, to guide people's lives. And one of my very favorite ones, also kind of about the Big Mama, is the one from India where the world begins as an endless smooth sea of milk. And in that sea, a little wavelet forms. And forever after, the little wavelet is torn between loving its own identity and wanting to merge back into the Big Mama. Now, I think that's the central tension of evolution. It's the tension between the part and the whole, between separation and union. And everything is driven by that, or the separateness of more than one, where you find that all these other forms, waves form, and they're all looking at each other and not realizing that they're still connected to the big sea, that they're waves in the sea. And that's such a lovely parable of how we are today, where we're trying to learn oneness. We're trying to learn how can you love your enemies, as Jesus said. The only way to love your enemies is to see connection with them, isn't it? Mm-hmm. If you're disconnected, you can't do that. But when you're connected, then you can start to see. And I remember somebody once saying, take the most heinous person you've ever heard of and imagine them as a little baby, because there are only two basic emotions in this universe, love and fear. And imagine that baby being afraid the first time, and you know what you would do. You would put your arms around it, right? So there's not a feeling of separation. The baby isn't threatening, and you know what to do. But if there were no loving arms for that baby, who knows what the vagaries of life can turn people into. Anyway, Eastern and Western creation stories are often about this differentiation from unity. You have some unity and then the individual form within it. Individuation is an essential stage of evolution, but so is collaboration. You see, the first stage is the individuation, and then we have to figure out how to recognize our oneness and come back into it. Now, The Eastern religions, such as Vedic science, taught cosmic consciousness as the deepest reality. That there was this sea of milk, this field of consciousness, this awareness, this love, this light. All the words that we humans have tried to put on that as the original, the reality, the source of everything else. The Taoists, the Kodama in Japan, many indigenous cultures taught consciousness as fundamental. But this is only getting some attention in Western science now. Among some of us who have the credentials of Western science, who do not see consciousness as a late emergent product of a meaningless material universe, but as the source of the material universe itself. George Wald was a Nobel laureate biologist at Harvard. I don't know if you can read this at the back. But he assumed the existence of creative mind throughout biological evolution. So we have a tradition of mavericks in science earlier than my contemporaries. George Wald was the generation before us, who did insist that you cannot understand nature without understanding the intelligence behind it within it, whatever you want to call it. And so I began to ask questions like, do brain neurons really generate consciousness? Many neurobiologists are trying to squeeze consciousness out of the brain, that the matter gives rise to it. Or is the brain perhaps an interface between the external perceptual stimuli coming at us and our internal consciousness? These are questions now. Is the whole universe thought, floating in divine cosmic mind? That's how the Eastern religions have portrayed it. And I found this very appealing, as you will see. Here's our friend again, Umofu. The questioning mind of our time does not have a problem with divinity. It has major problems with how the formal religions construe that belief. And this is what I'm finding everybody that I have interacted with in the progressive Catholic world asking, you know, does the bearded man in the sky make sense to us anymore? And one of the ancient Greeks said, if God is a man, who will the horses worship? And in my dialogue with Tom Berry, as I told Gail this morning, the priest who had been in shorts all week, so I didn't realize he was the priest of this retreat center, beautiful big mop of white hair, and put on a surplice and did a communion ceremony under a tree outdoors, and told a story of three divinity students in search of God. And he said at the end of the story, the one who found God was the female divinity student, and she found God swimming with dolphins. So these are very beautiful stories now that are coming into even very traditional religions such as Catholicism. Now, creation stories were always given by cultural authorities of one sort or another. As you know, this is Venus being born on the half shelf. But in the past few centuries, the Enlightenment, the rational approach to the world, the industrial enterprises that started in Europe, the Industrial Revolution, and which led then to secular states, meant that cultural authority shifted from religion to science. Right? In a secular state, we have this separation of church and state. And so science is now mandated to determine the creation story for the whole dominant world culture. Now that's a very, very serious responsibility. And I think that the very foundations of Western science will have to be changed if this is ever going to work. The Western scientific story of reality, I think, is the strangest creation story we've ever heard. It's about living in a mindless mechanical universe with ourselves as complex machinery. And this is, as I speak, there's a conference going on at the Salk Institute down in La Jolla, where I spent last weekend. And it has some of the most hard-nosed Western scientists there talking about this worldview. And then there are some others who are, because this is an opener for the Salk Institute to also have religion being represented there. And I'm looking forward to seeing some of the talks from that, which I think will be posted on the internet. Anyway, the scientific worldview of Newton and Descartes was of this non-living, non-conscious, mechanical universe in which humans are just complex robots. And I have to say, they don't look like they're having much fun. These clockwork universe models appealed to the early scientists enamored of mechanical inventions because they reasoned, look, if the universe were machinery, we could understand it. Right? You can see why they would reason that way. We are inventors. They were heady inventors. This was new stuff to make machines and change production and all the stuff, the clock towers with all the 12 apostles clanking around in them, you know, things like that. And they said, wow, you know, we're made in the image of God. And Descartes said, God is the grand engineer who invented all the machinery of nature. And he put a piece of his God mind into man so that he too could invent machinery. Well, we'll talk a little more about that in a minute. But here we have now science and the industrial entrepreneurs are getting together, funded by the stolen New World gold and silver, and replacing the European rule by church and state, which was the old alliance. And of course, scientists hadn't had a happy time with the church, and I don't need to tell you the details of that. Now, the two great stories of Western science that give us our secular nation worldview are one half of it comes from physics, and it says this is a non-living universe running down by entropy. And then along comes Darwin, and we get the biology side about endless struggle and scarcity. So it's a get what you can while you can kind of mentality here, isn't it? And this, sadly, is the main story being told by Western science today. So we've got to do something about that. And the first thing I had to do about that, after hearing the CEO of a new chain of banks on the East Coast get up at a spirit and science conference and talk about how very spiritual his company was, how wonderful they were to their employees, how groovy everything was in the company, and then he ended saying, and we're sustainable because we've knocked out most of our competition. And I said, okay, winner takes all. So at the end I said, excuse me, sir, I'm not sure I got your definition of sustainability correct. Would you mind repeating it? And he said the same thing and looked at me and said, he didn't know who I was or that I was on the program later. He said, madam, you've got to realize this is a Darwinian dog-eat-dog world. And it was in that moment that I realized that these businessmen, in good faith, talking about building a spiritual company, believe they stand on good science when they say that. And I was so bothered by this that trying to do a writing retreat in Tuscany a couple of years ago, all I could think of was that, and I started writing about the dangers of Darwinism. Anyway, Thomas Malthus, you may remember, inventoried Earth's resources as the chief economist of the first great multinational corporation of this world, which was called the East India Company. There were 8 East India Companies, French, Dutch, Swedish, Portuguese, and so on. We threw tea into Boston Harbor in our first protest against multinationals, right? Interesting. Malthus concluded that the world would end soon because human populations were going to overwhelm food production. Okay? And this is what justified the East India Company's after-them policy, all of colonialism, acquiring as many resources for Europeans as they could. Because if any way was going to survive, it had better be them. Right? Now, what's interesting is, at this same time, Darwin is exploring marvels of nature all over the world, and he's searching for an evolution theory. Well, Malthus was a family friend of the Darwin. Oops. Sorry. And Darwin adopted Malthus's theory of competitive struggle and scarcity as his own theory of evolution. So this socio-political theory was adopted by Darwin, who then said the universal struggle for life must be thoroughly ingrained in the mind, or nature will be dimly seen or quite misunderstood. It is the doctrine of Malthus applied with manifold force to the whole animal and vegetable kingdom. This is in the Origin of Species. There can be no dispute about this. It's interesting, I was on the Tavis Smiley radio show this past week. I think you can still download it at the Tavis Talks website if you want. Just about 15 minutes, and the woman wrote to me afterwards and started talking about how Darwinian theory was Malthusian. She's the first one, she's in Canada, who I have ever encountered who knew this. Anyway, many scientists now are telling a new story of our universe and our planet, our Earth, and us. And once again, Mr. Oumuamua, the ultimate questions for which people are seeking theological wisdom relate to meaning and purpose in the complex universe of our time. And I think that's why you all are exploring now the writings of Catholics who are seeing things in new ways. Now, to me, a valid scientific model of reality must be a model of our experience of reality through human consciousness. To sweep this under the rug and pretend that we have experiences anywhere but within our consciousnesses doesn't make sense to me. So I think science has to openly acknowledge that it is building models of the universe as seen through human consciousness, and a certain kind of set of beliefs. Now, science rests on fundamental beliefs, and they are such beliefs as that this is a non-living universe. Now, no other culture, to my knowledge, has ever had a concept of non-life. They all know what life and death is. They all understand recycling, things like that. But non-life is something that never was alive, and somehow magically comes to life. Right? So it implies that consciousness must be fundamental to a scientific model. And the way I see it, there is a cosmic consciousness, as in the Eastern religions, the Vedic and so forth. And you could call this, you know, the source of multiverse, because nowadays scientists seem to think there's more than one universe. And then we have our local human consciousness, our own experience, which only through inner contemplation connects with cosmic consciousness, right? William James said consciousness is a perch and a flight. It needs a perch from which to rest and take off. It needs you as a unique individual to be a source of consciousness within the great field of cosmic consciousness. So each of us is local consciousness creating our reality within cosmic consciousness. And that means that we are the creative edge of cosmic consciousness, or all that is, or divine mind, or God, depending on what name you put to the mystery, the unknown, that we, it's not a mystery in the sense that we know it's there. But it's a mystery in terms of how do you describe it, right? People haven't been very successful at describing the indescribable. But the realities that each of us creates affect each other's realities, and so we each have responsibility in creating our shared whole. And that shared whole now is about building global family, which we'll see in a minute. Now, my favorite metaphor for trying to understand the world is cosmic consciousness, divine mind, God, as that endless sea, whatever, love, life. And then we have a keyboard of vibrations with matter in the loci. This is where science started to understand the universe, by looking at the slow vibrations of matter. Then they figured out how to measure electromagnetic energy, which a little over 100 years ago was considered very woo-woo New Age stuff that scientists couldn't possibly believe in. But once they get to measure something, it comes into the world of scientific reality. No, because that's how they define reality, as the measurable. So taste and smell and things in Galileo's time, those were figments of the imagination, and we learned how to measure things about them, so they came into the scientific world. Now, Einstein showed us with his famous E equals MC squared equation that you could transpose the music back and forth between the mid-range and the low keys, that it was all the same thing, that it's all energy. Right? That matter is a kind of congealed energy. Now science is all the way up to the zero-point energy field in the highest vibrations of the electromagnetic energy spectrum. Now, meanwhile, the religious and spiritual people started at the other end of the keyboard, with mind and spirit and consciousness of God. And they didn't see that they were all playing on the same keyboard. And that's what we need to recognize now, is that this is one universe for all of us, and that we are all made of everything on this keyboard. Right? We're not bodies housing a consciousness. We're a consciousness giving rise to bodies. We recreate ourselves a gazillion times a second. It's an amazing thing. Physics describes the universe as self-organizing energy. My favorite unification theory in physics, where the outstanding problem is how to get radiation and gravity together into the same theory. Because the expanding universe that's running down is what we see through telescopes, because we're seeing radiation. That's all you see is light. The light bodies of the universe. The light coming from the stars and so forth is what you see in a telescope. Gravity is unseen but measurable. And the scientists cannot figure out how to put these things together, but I tell you, there is nothing in nature that doesn't have its opposite. You cannot have a one-way universe. You can't have a universe that's running down by entropy, because it's got to be balanced by centropy. And so I was calling it syntropy. My friend Nassim Haramein was calling it centropy. Sounds almost identical, but I had a more biological notion of it. Anabolism and catabolism, the build-up and the breakdown. Centrifugal, centrifugal, the outreach and the heartbeater, right? There's always an opposite. So I believe this universe is in continual creation in the great eternal now. It is not running down. There is just as much inward gravity, love, pregnancy, as there is outward flying apart radiation. And I call myself a post-Darwinian evolution biologist because life is simply too intelligent to proceed by accident. Too intelligent to proceed by accident. If your genome did not know when a mutation happens, and they happen all the time due to radiation and accidents of reproduction in the cell and stuff, if your body didn't know, your genome, when a mutation had occurred, it couldn't repair it. And the Darwinian theory demands that one in a million mutation that might help evolution along has to be singled out as one not to repair or throw out. This is very difficult to explain in Darwinian terms. We now have more than a half a century of scientific evidence showing us that evolution occurs when DNA reorganizes itself in response to stress. Barbara McClintock got a Nobel Prize after being laughed at for most of her career for showing this, that the genome actually changes itself when there's pressure on it to change because something's going wrong. Now, every time something goes wrong with the Earth, like a giant extinction, usually because a planetoid has struck the Earth or something and there's dramatic climate change, you get bunches of new species all over the planet in the fossil record all at once. Not the slow Darwinian evolution, but as if the Earth is working as a whole. And after all, DNA is completely interchangeable among everything from bacteria to plants and animals. Right? That's why they can put fish genes into your strawberries. So your strawberries won't freeze in the field, right? And things like that, which has some vegetarian very upset. But since the cell, they're breathing you know, he said we're breathing each other's DNA all the time, and viruses and prions and plasmids and bacteria and things like that. We change genes constantly. But the body is an intelligent system that can keep things stable despite all this going around. So on the earth, I say no creature is a thing in itself apart from all others. We are all in a very unified situation. Now, do you know about the poet Rumi? Some of you have heard Rumi. This is my favorite Rumi poem. Even after all this time, the sun never once says to the earth, Earth, you owe me. Look what happens with a love like that. It lights up the whole sky. Isn't that a beautiful, beautiful Rumi poem? This is natural economics. Gifting. Just providing for each other. This whole big argument now about evolution versus creationism. Or Darwinism. Creationism. Yeah. Creationism or Darwinism. Which one are we going to believe in? Well, I think what's happening is the fundamentalists on both sides are digging their heels in with no intention of coming to an agreement. And I'm not interested in arguments where people are not interested in any kind of conflict resolution. So, I call myself sometimes a creationist evolution biologist. This started when I had a gig in the Middle West and a newspaper reporter called me up and said, I don't think many people will come out for an evolution biologist. So I said, well, look, just write in the paper that a creationist evolution biologist is coming and see if they don't come out just to find out what that is. So they did, and it worked wonderfully well. We had really good dialogue. I don't see why we can't heal this split. After all, nature is wildly creative, isn't it? And it's all, to me, rooted in God's cosmic consciousness, whatever your name is. Now, this Western science view of God as the inventor of nature's machinery was logical because God put that mind in man so that he too could create machinery. So it was kind of a complete system. However, that complete system became illogical when they threw God out of the picture, saying we have no more need for the hypothesis of God. So they threw God's purpose and intelligence out of nature, but kept the concept of machinery, calling it natural machinery. This is illogical. Why? Because there's no such thing as a machine without an inventor. That's why. So I don't think they should get away with it anymore. It does not make sense. And machinery is a useful metaphor to a point. But, for example, scientists called the brain a plumbing system in Freud's day, right? Things got clogged up and valves had to be, pipes had to be cleaned out and stuff like that, valves open. And then we invented the telephone, and the brain suddenly became a telephone switchboard. That was a new mechanical metaphor for the brain. Then the computer came along, the brain's computer. Then the holographic camera came along. Oh, it's a hologram. It's a holographic device. Now it's a parallel processor. So as our technology gets more sophisticated, we approach maybe what the brain is. But there are problems with mechanism that make it very hard to understand life, using that as a metaphor. Now, people are recognizing that we're not machines, that we are living beings. And I started to wonder, what if Galileo had looked down into a drop of pond water and seen all those squiggly things instead of up into the heavens, which had already been defined as celestial mechanics in his day? Might then biology have become the leading science rather than physics? Maybe a fall of a historical accident, right? So then I had to ask myself, well, what is life? And there was no really good definition of life anywhere. The chemists thought the biologists had, the biologists thought the chemists or the physicists had it, and we got along for a long time with just talking about attributes of life, like motility, irritability, growth, reproduction, remember that kind of thing from biology courses. But now we do have a new definition of life, and it's autopoiesis, autopoiesis in Greek. And it says that a living entity continually creates itself in relation to its environment. A living thing can't exist without an environment from which to draw its nourishment and to use as a sink for its waste. But this is very different from that list because, for one thing, notice that it doesn't say anything about size or reproductive capacity. So if anybody here has opted not to have children in this lifetime, you still are alive. Is it a living entity may or may not reproduce? It doesn't have to be alive. So this was interesting because then I had to ask myself, what's the simplest form that can continually create itself? And I came to the concept of a spiral or a whirlpool in water where the water is swirling around in a spiral and it keeps taking in new water and letting out old water while holding its form. What do? We take in food and water and air and we constantly transform and recreate ourselves and let out what we don't need. So there's a relationship here with the whole universe. What after all is this form, the galactic form, is that kind of a self-organizing spiral? Can that mean that the universe is not non-life, but life? If God is the universe, is creation, it has to be alive. And so I was looking for a way of showing this with the organs, galaxies like organs in the universe to try to start to see it this way, as all God's creation is alive. Now, you can't see this very well, but I coined the word allopoietic to balance autopoietic. Autopoietic means self-creation, so the producer and the product are one. You grow from a single egg. And that egg is evolving itself into a whole being. So the producer and the product are the same thing, right? With allopoietic entities, like machinery, the producer and the product are separate. You have a producer here and he makes the machine, right? So an organism is autopoietic, a mechanism is allopoietic. And so you see that an allopoietic mechanism, like allopathic medicine from the outside, you make an intervention, is assembled, its rules are given by its inventor, it's hierarchic in a control system, it's reinvented periodically. We talk about generations of computers, but we know they don't give birth to each other, and it has to be repaired when it's broken. An allopoietic entity grows itself, it rules itself from within, it's holarchic, meaning layers of embedded cells within organs and so on, within bodies. It evolves over time and it repairs itself remarkably. That's very different. If you walk away from a friend, you hope that friend keeps changing because if they don't, they'd be dead. Mm-hmm. If you walk away from your computer, you hope that it doesn't change very John, or it's probably broken, because machines are notoriously poor at improving themselves. Mm-hmm. Now look at the desert religions, which are Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and Protestantism. And the Eastern religions, like Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, and Nikota Dhamma, and you'll see that the Eastern religions are autopoietic in the sense that they have an internal creation. And the Western religions have an external creator god. So long after I thought up these two terms or used the term autopoietic, added the term allopoietic, for science, I realized this is also useful in understanding the religions of the world. Because on one side of the planet, we develop this cosmic consciousness giving rise within itself to all of creation. While on the other side, we had a creator god who stood outside of his creation. And I think this is what the dialogue really comes down to in essence now, is to talk about disconfiguration and see what it means to us. So in my version of evolution, it's an improvisational dance co-created by atoms, molecules, cells, ourselves, and the rest of nature, all as aspects of God. The religious science church has a banner that reads, God is all there is. I love, personally, I gravitate toward that view. And that's why I want Western science to adopt the Eastern Vedic consciousness is pervasive, it's all that is, as the foundation of Western science, which is very good at building equipment and extending our perceptions in ways that we like extending them to get better understanding of things. So, now, to understand living systems and evolution, I extracted two essential patterns from them, and they are holarchy and an evolution cycle. And very, very briefly, the cycle of evolution starts with a unity, individuates, tension and conflict arises when you have individuals. But if they don't kill themselves off at this Darwinian stage, you see, this is Darwin so far, they start to negotiate some of their differences, find resolutions, build cooperative schemes, and eventually build a new unity at a higher level. That's what evolution is about. It's a learning curve. Now, ecologists talk about type 1 ecosystems populated by pioneer species who take all the resources they can get, hog territory, multiply as fast as they can, and are very competitive trying to knock out their competition. Does that sound familiar? Okay, this is the Darwinian mode that we have built our whole global business world on. But they also recognize type 3 ecosystems as sharing territory, sharing resources, helping ensure the life of other species and being far more cooperative. Rainforests, prairies, coral reefs. There's a learning curve here, but the scientists don't see any connection. They don't see a connection, even though they call them pioneers and climax ecosystems. In the so three, it's called the climax. And if you ask them, well, how do you get from being a pioneer to being in a climax ecosystem? They say six different kinds of species. I said, I don't think so. We know the whole story of the ancient bacteria. They did all kinds of hostilities before they learned to cooperate. But they did eventually. And so everything in our biological world is at some stage of that cycle. But some species are still young and others are mature. I think you get what I'm working up to here. So nature shows both cooperation and competition. And nature doesn't do our human either ors, but is very conservative when things are working well and radically creative when they don't work. When you've had an extinction. The hot age that's coming upon us means that we're going to have to get very creative. Okay, the other one was the easy one, holons and holarchy. This is just this kind of embeddedness in nature, or you could say a person within a family, within a community, within an ecosystem, within a nation, within a world, or a planet, within a galaxy, within a cluster of galaxies in a universe. Now, if I put those two things together, the cycle and the embeddedness, then we can see this cycle happening all at once, this push from individual tension to cooperation by looking at your own body and realizing that every one of your cells has to meet its self-interest, every organ has to meet its self-interest, every level of holarchy is negotiating constantly to meet its needs. And so self-interest is only a problem when it's not contained by the self-interest of a larger community. That makes sense? You have to dialogue back and forth. So if your body's economy will run the way our world economy is run, these northern industrial organs, the heart lung system, we're going to give them the power to exploit the bone marrow mines all over the body for the raw material blood cells. That's where they're actually formed. So we're going to bring these raw material blood cells up to the heart-lung system, where blood is purified, oxygen is added. All these things really happen, except for the ownership part, to make the final blood product. And then the heart distribution center announces what the body price for blood today is and ships it to those organs who can afford it. You see, you can recognize immediately that this extremely sophisticated body of yours that has 100 trillion cells in it, each of which is so complex that it needs 30,000 recycling centers to keep it healthy. Every cell that you can't even see with your eye has 30,000 recycling centers within it. It's the complexity of a large human city. And here you sit with all of those 100 trillion cells working in concert to keep you alive and healthy. Why do we think 6 billion people is a lot to weave into a global community? Right? Nature is very complicated. And we can see that our bodies wouldn't stay healthy in that kind of an economic system, so we can ask, can our world? If we think holistically, we'll get the connection between the local and the global, right? Because a living system, no matter what its size, has to operate by the same basic principles. So why don't we have this kind of win-win dynamic harmony, this mutual consistency within our species yet, if we have it within our bodies? And I think the reason is that we're in the habit of about 10,000 year legacy of empire building. And that was always based on warfare and win-lose economics. So to me, it is time now, and this was true whether they were the original empires or national empires or now corporate empires, they're all win-lose systems. Whereas your body is a win-win system. An ecosystem, if it's mature, is a win-win. If it's immature, it's a win-lose. Isn't it interesting that women teach, mothers teach their kids not to take things away from each other and not to hit each other, and then they turn on the television and what are big people doing? You know, there's a great hypocrisy between knowing what's right, knowing that it's that you turn the other cheek and get the shirt off your back and love your enemies deeply, and being able to carry that out in the world, right? That's the challenge of Christianity. Now, globalization to me is a natural evolutionary process with global cooperation already happening in many ways. In the arts, in travel, in our communications with now an internet where we can have huge global conversations, change money across all languages and cultures, have an international space station, have more frequent world parliaments of religion and much interfaith dialogue, the United Nations, scientific cooperation. These are evidence. From air traffic control to world parliaments of religion, that we're ready to be a cooperative global species. We can do it. And the people want it. Before we attacked Iraq, millions of people around the world said, no, there's a more mature way to do things. And many victims of 9/11 said, no, we want to build up Iraq, or if, in fact, that had anything to do with it. We don't want to destroy anymore. The Dominican nun that I was with in Long Island smuggled $1 million on their bodies in lay clothes to their sisters in Iraq. That's great risk to their own lives because the American embargoes were preventing their Iraqi Dominican sisters to be able to serve the women and children. And Saddam, by the way, was not interfering with their work. But how gutsy is that? You know, it's amazing. Anyway, if what we need is negotiated self-interest at all levels of the world system, just as it happens in your body, so I'll call it globalization. I'll call it globalization, and the World Trade Organization can never build a healthy world economy until they get that they must support healthy local economies. And that's what the protests are always trying to show, that the negotiations from below are coming up and saying, we want to live, we want to live. You've got to make the whole system work, not just a top-down hierarchy of the richest nations and enterprises in the world for their benefit. So 7 reasons why I remain an optimist at 70 are, 1, the worldview and theories of science are changing. The universe is alive and well. It's not running down by entropy. We don't have to get what we can while we can. We create our own reality. We need beliefs and dreams and courage and energy. And then we can change the world for the better. I see young people on the internet showing little interest in racism, warfare, or greed. In one generation, they could create a new world. Imagine all the young people making pacts with each other not to kill each other over any differences. Wouldn't that be amazing? That is not the mature way to solve hostility. I think they could do it. People achieve their dreams with motivation more than with money. And I don't have the time to go into some of these projects like Red Flag Canal in China here, which when I visited there in 1974 was a completely barren mountainside. And that's a canal that was created by young people with no money but tons of motivation by smelting iron out of their dry red desert floor and making tools and chipping into these mountains and blasting tunnels with homemade dynamite and bringing a river across 70 kilometers of mountains into a valley of 500 little villages that were dying of complete starvation drought. I have a friend who can green any desert piece in the world, has greened the Antsokia Valley in Ethiopia when it was the poster child for African starvation. We can do things like that at low cost. Bhutan is measuring its economy by decree of the king in happiness, which means quality of life rather than money flow. When you measure an economy in money flow, the worse things get, the better the economy is. Because it takes so much to repair and restore and stuff. We need to get out of the oil age with that last slide. I'm not going to bother going back to it. But global warming, I think, is a peace process because disaster brings out our best. And this is a common disaster for all of humanity. 13 of our largest 20 cities are going to have to be moved. Are we going to move them into the same kind of city uphill? Or are the young generation going to reinvent livable green cities? All these things are so possible now. If we get out of the oil age and do things in the way of nature, instead of using hydrocarbons, we'll use carbohydrates to make all kinds of sophisticated materials, as does nature, at ambient temperatures with no waste. The oil age products are made with 96% waste in the production process, and the 4% that ends up as a car or a computer ends up in a landfill a few years later. So we must look to nature, its vast intelligence, its sacredness, its huge experience. And the Dalai Lama said in Castel Gandolfo in Rome two summers ago, where he had a dialogue with him, "The most important meditation you can do now is critical thinking followed by action." Interesting. Discern what's going on in your world. See the evolutionary mandate to create win-win world economics within sacred nature to truly become a global family. Thank you so much.
I have one thing I want to say, and then we're going to take a stretch break and then have some time for questions. I'm sure a lot of you have questions. But I'm going to repeat something that I said last week, just because of how this strikes me, listening to them this morning. But what Cynthia Bourgeau began with in a quote from the Gospel of Thomas, that says, "Seek and you will find, and when you find, you will become confused, and your confusion will turn to wonder, and in wonder you will reign." Well, when I listen to Barbara Hubbard and Elizabeth, it takes me out of such a narrow frame that I've been used to live and breathe and think in into wonder and mystery, so that I don't ever want to go back to saying, I have it all figured out. In our faith tradition, we have the truth, have the key. We'll never figure out the mystery we live in. I think all we can do is celebrate it and appreciate it and try to cooperate. Thank you for that. That's what that is for me.